Right, everything's ready to go.
Let's do this.
Everything's ready to go. Let's do this. Which can mean only one thing. It's time for the Linux Boys podcast, episode 13?
14.
Series 40. 3. Who knows where the time goes? So sang Sandy Denny. She has nothing to do with this podcast. I do. My name's Andrew Gregory.
I'm Ben Everard.
I'm Graham Morrison.
And I'm Mike Saunders.
And we've got news to come. We've got finds of the fortnight, also known as discoveries of the fortnight. We've got a voice of the masses, but we don't have any vocalizer neurons.
No, I don't know why, Andrew, but we don't have any.
Well, if you have anything that you'd like to get off your chest and would like read out by the dulcet tones of Mike Saunders San on this very podcast, send it to him on the email. Right, let's start, shall we? Normally, I tell people to buy the magazine that we do at this stage, but I think I'll just drop it in later.
Wow.
So that brings us straight on to the news. Item one. First two items, actually, this fortnight are all about Firefox. So first off, there's an exploit in Firefox. Quite a bad one, actually, specifically in the pdf.js inbuilt PDF viewer, which it doesn't allow remote code exploitation, but it allows an attacker to sort of go digging through your file system and reading all sorts of stuff that they shouldn't be allowed to read, including, and probably most severely for Linux users, any SSH keys you've got. So if you've got certificate-based SSH logins set up and you use Firefox, you should regenerate your SSH keys and update Firefox to either version 39.0.3 or 38.1.1, which are the safe versions.
Is 38 an extended release or something? Is that
yes,
why it's...
Yes, yeah, it is. It's the updated. ESR version.
That's a terrifying exploit. And, you know, we read about exploits all the time, and often I'm kind of like, eh. But this one's like, how the hell does that happen?
Well, it's in the PDF reader, isn't it? Which is a whole giant application in itself. I remember when that was added to Firefox, and a lot of people said, yeah, great idea, guys. Now you've got another huge attack surface built into your web browser. Okay, it's convenient to be able to view PDFs inside, but, you know, the more that a browser becomes an operating system, the more that things like this are going to happen. But I wonder if Firefox should just have in its code a block from reading any .dot files.
Mm.
That would make sense. I know it needs to read files across the file system if you want to open a local HTML file, but blocking .dot files would make sense.
Until you try and load your .dot Firefox profile.
Oh, apart from that one, yeah.
I don't actually know if that is the file, I'm just guessing. I mean, another solution would be to sandbox Firefox completely. How often? Well, you do need to open files occasionally, I suppose, but...
It is a problem that really worried me, though. I mean, that does have, like, such serious ramifications for anybody who connects to any server, and also something that you kind of assume is so secure and you usually forget about once you've generated those keys.
Yeah, definitely.
And it's a difficult fix as well, because you have to log on to all of those machines again to be able to change the keys or the authorized keys file.
Unless you're Mike, where you change your key first and then try and log on to change it.
I'm not very clever.
Was that your Raspberry Pi, Mike?
Where?
What? Yeah, your iPlayer Raspberry Pi located in Cumbria.
Oh, that.
It was quite an annoying one to fix. And, well, to be fair, this could have been solved by using... Because you can encrypt your SSH keys when you create them. You have the option to create a password. And then they're symmetric key encrypted, which would have been the better solution to this problem. But I don't think anyone actually does that.
No, because most people are using them to get around entering passwords on remote servers.
Yeah, maybe we need a certificate for our SSH certificates.
Yeah, or something like the YubiKey, which there's a tutorial for that in an upcoming issue of Linux Voice.
Yeah, Yeah, two-factor authentication. Maybe this is just another reminder that we should all be using that. But more Firefox security news, in fact. Firefox version 42 and later will require all extensions to be signed by Firefox before they can be used. Is this a case of the single organization trying to build a walled garden, or is it a better idea for security for end users? Discuss.
I think it makes a lot of sense. Sorry, Mike. I think it's a good thing. I mean, it's very similar. It's a very similar thing to the secure boot stuff. But you know, we've just shown how fragile the web browser is and how easy it is to exploit. And I'm hoping there'd still be a way of turning it off for those of us who don't want to rely on signed only add-ons and extensions. But for most people, I think it'll be an added security feature.
There is no way of turning it off. However, the nightly and dev versions don't have it. So if you use the standard version of Firefox, you have to have everything signed, even stuff you've created yourself.
Or is that going to be them enforcing their Firefox trademark and IPR?
Well, they do make an unbranded version, which will have a switch.
Right.
And well, what a lot of people have pointed out, and that there isn't yet a solution to, is companies that have private extensions that they don't necessarily want to make public, but they need all their employees to install.
If they're big enough, they could roll their own certificates into Firefox. I guess it's just pretty straightforward. Sorry, Mike.
On a tangent, yesterday I helped remove an extension from a friend's Chrome installation. It was a really, really dodgy one. It stopped you actually going to the extension options page in the browser. In order to actually remove it, you go to options, extensions or add-ons, and then it would just close that tab automatically. So, but I went into Chrome's process manager and killed it, and then I could actually get into it. But it was a dodgy piece of software. I don't know how it got installed.
And Chrome,
yeah. And Chrome already requires everything to be signed.
Yeah, so no idea.
What do you think, Ben?
I think it's... I haven't personally come across any malicious Firefox extensions, so it feels... I'm sort of in two minds about it, because I think we generally do need a better chain of security in computers. It is already a huge problem. It's only going to get worse. The reason they've said they can't switch it off is that they reckon there'll be ways of tricking users into switching it off and getting them to install malicious extensions, which is perhaps true, but this seems a little heavy-handed.
I mean, it seems to work mostly okay for Android, I mean, without having done any research or anything, but the idea that you can install APKs from third parties is a really strong one for me. I like it, and surely there are a lot of people who just won't do it.
Yeah, I mean, that has attracted a lot of bad press for Google, not so much recently, but in the early sort of 3 or 4 years ago, there's all this stories about millions and millions of pieces of adware, and they were almost all on third-party app stores that were just loaded with rubbish.
But then the Flashlight one was the worst offender.
Yeah.
From Google Play.
Yeah. Is that why there's now a Flashlight built into Android 5?
I think it might be, yeah. It does feel like there's some kind of momentum building behind, I don't want to say a fork of Firefox, but a different kind of emphasized version, a different version of Firefox with a different emphasis.
You mean Ice Weasel?
Does Ice Weasel get rid of all the stuff like the PDF viewer, though?
I don't know about the PDF viewer. I suspect it includes it.
I thought it was just like a trademark-free version.
Yeah, I did.
I don't get why they couldn't have done something like you can install your own certificate, because no one's going to persuade a user that they need to build their own certificate and install it in.
Yeah.
So why can't there just be a directory that I can drop my public keys into and sign the extensions myself?
Yeah.
I don't know. Anyway, moving on from Firefox to more release news. LibreOffice 5.0 has been released to much fanfare, or some fanfare.
There should be lots of fanfare.
I read the sort of release notes from the Document Foundation, and it just read like it had been written by a PR agency who didn't know what the software was supposed to do. It was like harmonize things and synchronize other things and synergize this. And I was like, well, just tell me what it does that it didn't do before.
A lot of open source projects have that problem, I think. I mean, there's a new version of KDE on the horizon, and somebody's made like a new features video, and it's 55 minutes long with no narration and just a soundtrack in the back while somebody clicks along the desktop. It's like, I think we've mentioned it before, maybe in the old Cynics points, that there are developers like spending all their time adding new features, and yet so much of the time they can't be bothered to like, or somebody else can't be bothered to highlight them or say, look, this is great, this is what we've done, you know.
Yeah, I think the GNOME team have done pretty well in that regard in the past, issuing sort of release notes, you know, with new features, just clear, simple screenshots and feature benefits.
Yeah.
Also, on that note, I don't know if you guys saw on the Planet, I think it was the Planet GNOME blog, somebody was writing saying, sort of an open letter to the Apache Foundation saying, look, open office development is basically dead now that IBM has pulled out of it, yet people are still downloading it and getting, you know, pretty out-of-date software. There are security holes still there. Please, please, please point them to LibreOffice. It's so much better now, so much more activity. I don't know what will happen from that, but it's interesting.
It's a huge problem, and it's something that when we spoke to Michael Meeks last year, he highlighted that OpenOffice has just got the mind share of what a free office suite should be called and what it should look like. And they still have many more downloads, I think, than LibreOffice does. I think that's something that, and this is a major release of LibreOffice. They're doing a great job in terms of the number, something like less than 10% of the new features that go into LibreOffice go into openoffice.org. And that was in the old regime. OpenOffice.org is effectively dead. I personally think they maybe should reconsider moving back to the openoffice.org brand, because, you know, if there's any way that could be made possible. Because LibreOffice just suffers from that, the same reason why Libre wasn't chosen for the expression of free software open source.
I mean, this is the sort of stuff you can almost understand it from Oracle and IBM, because they've got various commercial interests and all that sort of stuff that they're trying to protect. But Apache should know better. I mean, this wasn't a snap decision for them to take it. They put it into whatever they called their incubator, and then they sort of brought it out and they made it an official project when it was clear exactly what was going on, that it was getting hardly any development and all this sort of stuff. And I don't know, maybe they got a big wadge of cash dropped in their pockets to do it or something, but it's really put them down in my estimation, to be honest.
I get the impression that the Apache Foundation are massively under-resourced, and they have this kind of meritocratic way of running their projects, especially through the incubator sections, where they actually want it to survive on its own needs. And so I think they've on their own legs. And so they've only pushed through OpenOffice purely because of the strength of its kind of download rate, rather than anybody giving it any time or anybody giving it any kind of love. I think it's bad for the Apache Foundation as well. Really, they should be building bridges to LibreOffice, because that's the moral right way forward.
Yeah, they either need to develop it into a proper project, you know, with contributors and actually moving along and fixing security holes and stuff, or let it die and send everyone over to LibreOffice.
Yeah. Just a redirect.
Yeah. Okay, next up in our release news is Privacy Badger 1.0 from the EFF has been released. This is an extension / add-on thingy for Chrome and Firefox.
And, with a superb logo.
With a superb logo. And it takes a slightly more nuanced approach than a lot of the privacy protector sort of NoScript and the blockers, and that it sort of looks for third-party requests that happen on a lot of sites. So it looks for servers that are pinging you on as you browse across and trying to build up a track of it, and then it blocks them. And it, again, it's a little bit intelligent in what it blocks at when they are legitimate things like logos that appear on a lot of sites. It blocks the cookies that can be used to track you. Now, I think it minimizes the fingerprinting as well, but still actually allows the content to load. So the idea behind this is that you get the advantages of less tracking and all that sort of stuff, but in general, it shouldn't break websites. They should continue to run as they do. As they're intended to.
Excellent. Fantastic initiative. Well done to the EFF.
Yeah, it looks like a really good privacy tool, although I haven't actually used it yet myself.
No, neither have I. I should install it.
Right. Next up on the news is Lenovo doing bad things again. Lenovo, why do you keep breaking stuff? This is a BIOS-level exploit that's basically when you boot a Lenovo machine, the BIOS searches your C drive for particular files in Windows and sees if they're the official Microsoft versions. If they are the official Microsoft versions, it thinks, oh, you haven't got the backdoored Lenovo versions. I'll install those for you. So it installs the backdoored Lenovo versions, which then are easily exploitable. They do all sorts of stuff without any security check, and they download stuff over plain HTTP, which allows anyone to inject anything that then gets run with administrator level privileges. Executes it. It all got tucked away, and it was only discovered after some security researcher noticed that when he reinstalled Windows, he was getting some dodgy Lenovo versions, not some official Microsoft versions.
This is really horrible, isn't it? It's typically been the case that if you want to run Windows without lots of crapware, you just reinstall a fresh version from Microsoft. But now you can't, on these Lenovo machines, you can't even escape that. I mean, it's another plus point for Linux at the moment.
Yeah. Well, there wouldn't, in theory, be anything to stop a vendor doing this with Linux. I mean, if you've got access to the browser and you can read the file system, you can do whatever you want. You know, this could load kernel modules, this could patch anything.
And it would be legal in Linux. I don't know whether, I doubt Lenovo's got some kind of official agreement with Microsoft, but surely if they're patching like DLLs and stuff like that provided by Microsoft, they're breaking the law.
I wouldn't have thought so. I'm sure OEMs are allowed to do stuff like that.
Why?
I don't know for sure.
Why would Lenovo do this?
Because they're fools.
But what is the software
what's
that
the perceived advantage of? Like, is it for peddling ads to us or something?
Well, it's hard to say because this is the same company that put in Superfish. So, there's a whole chain of stuff. What this did was a Lenovo support extension, I think they called it, and it allowed Lenovo to do various things in sort of forcing you to update or not update things and keeping you in check. So they probably thought they were helping you out.
Ministry of Peace.
Yeah, that sort of stuff. But theoretically, I think this could have been used to sort of reinstall Superfish and that sort of stuff and allow them to get a lot more control over your laptop.
In the case of Superfish, that was on Lenovo's consumer line laptops and not the ThinkPads, wasn't it? Does this affect ThinkPads?
No, this doesn't. This is the consumer line.
Still, okay. But nonetheless, it's tarnishing their reputation, all this.
Yeah, and to be fair, we may be being unfair to Lenovo. They may just be the ones that are being caught. We haven't heard that other ones aren't doing it. We just don't know for sure. Lenovo have now admitted that this is a problem and offered a patch to the BIOS to allow you to stop it. But who's going to patch their BIOS? I mean, I genuinely think this is the sort of thing, at this point, they should recall them, fix them for you. And, you know, because they have put a major and hard-to-remove exploit in your system deliberately. They should be the ones tasked with fixing it. And that's also the only way that, you know, the hardware manufacturers are going to realize that this is a bad thing if they actually have to dip into their pockets to fix the problems they cause.
Yeah, in any other industry, if you were selling other products with such major flaws or vulnerabilities, there would be a product recall, wouldn't there?
Yeah, and there should be. Mm. Yes, we shall see. Okay, let's move back to more Linux-related news and slightly happier Linux-related news. Plasma Mobile, KDE's sort of mobile OS, has had a prototype release for the Nexus 5. It looks fantastic. I don't know if you guys have seen the videos of this running. It kind of looks pretty much like you'd expect KDE to run on a phone. If you ever used any of the older versions of KDE Mobile, it's all very slick, very cutie. It's certainly a similarity to Sailfish, I think, with it, although it is quite different. And it seems to run quite well on the Nexus 5, although I don't have one to test it on. But the age-old problem with mobile OS is persuading companies to put them on and sell them. And it's unlikely you're ever going to get market share without that. And as far as I can see, there's no hardware manufacturers lined up to partner with KDE on this.
I'll have to give it a go, as I've got a Nexus 5. I haven't tried it.
Yeah, it really does look good. It's very slick, very, very KDE-ish. But I couldn't see a cashew, which was quite nice. And there was no blue glow behind the windows.
I've had a couple of messages from people that, because I've always had a go at that blue glow, saying they like the blue glow and to leave it alone.
So isn't it a green glow in SUSE?
It could be. I don't know. I don't like it. I think it's horrible. It replaces where the drop shadow should be. But
well, how could you have a shadow when you're emitting neon behind your window?
Oh, that just reminds me of Gen 2 Rices.
To be honest, it's not the blue glow that annoys me so much. It's the fact that it's really hard to find the configuration option to get rid of it.
Yes, it is. It is.
If it was just an option that was easily tweakable, it'd be fine. But you've got to dig through miles to find it.
It is, and it's really not obvious. It's like some weird style setting where you have to go in and customise. I've noticed that quite a few KDE users have started to use Kwin running on Wayland.
Oh, okay.
I've not had a chance to try it, but the latest update in Arch seemed to have quite a few users running Wayland, so I had to roll back the latest update to KDE in Arch. So I haven't been brave enough to go back, as my desktop was broken. And so too now is my Kmail email database, because it was already upgraded. It's horrible. It's all my own fault. I didn't read the...
was it a Wayland problem that broke it? Or?
No, I'm not using Wayland. So, no, there was just some conflict with the Baloo file sorting algorithm daemon with some of the testing packages that I was running in combination with the unstable packages, of course.
It still beats my Ubuntu install, which still can't make any file changes because of the...
Because of ButterFS?
Yeah. I've just switched over to Arch and thinking, I'll fix it when I've got a minute.
And then it'll be 2 years' time, and God, I've got to get this stuff off.
Yeah. I can at least get stuff off the file system. It's not completely nadged, which is good. And let's switch over to the other desktop of note in Linux for our final item of news. And GNOME can now go out and be served in pubs. It turned 18 on Saturday the 15th of August. So a slightly belated happy birthday, GNOME.
That was quite a good image in my head, GNOME's buying beer.
Yeah.
Surely it depends on the metabolic rate of a GNOME.
What, whether it's legally allowed to buy beer?
Yeah.
Is this like a dog years or 7 years?
Yeah, I don't know how long gnomes live. Gnome? I don't know how long gnomes live.
That's it.
Wow, we're all getting old though, aren't we? I can kind of remember those early versions of Gnome.
I'm only 10 in gnome years.
Was it called Flux? It used to be the default for a long time. It had those little square bits and bobs and like the gradient in the top corner.
Everything was gradients, wasn't it? The gradients on the back of buttons and toolbars.
I remember when it used Sawmill as the window manager. I think that was GNOME 1.0. Or did it have Enlightenment there? I forget now.
And that whole easel stuff, do you remember?
I remember, was Easel the company that created Nautilus? I remember them getting $10 million of venture capital funding to build a file manager.
I know.
$10 million. Those were the good old days.
That was like the dot-com boom, wasn't it? It was like the original startup culture.
Exactly. I don't know what they were promising to do at the time. And, you know,
eventually
they
made it.
Yeah, they made a fairly good file manager out of it, but $10 million?
The desktop environment I miss is the old XFCE when it was CD style with the little drawers at the bottom and Windows minimized to the desktop. And it was actually a desktop. You had your desktop on which you could put documents, you had your drawers you could open to find things.
But, you know, Ben, I'm pretty sure CDE is now open source and you can... I bet it's in the Arch user repository or something. Give it a go.
CD is open source now.
Yeah, so hopefully somebody's maintaining it and keeping it compiling on the latest Xorg servers. So
I did have a look a few years ago and it wouldn't compile. I don't know if it's been, if anyone started maintaining it.
You probably...
That would be pretty cool.
Yeah. Running your screen resolution, anything over 320 by 240.
Yeah, I can pretend I'm on an old Spark 1. And that's all the news this fortnight.
Excellent. So it's time for Finds of the Fortnight, and it has been a fortnight, I think. I asked the IRC channel just before we started recording, and I don't know whether it's because it's summer here in the UK and people have had breaks from being out of the office, but there are loads. So you have to bear with me, and they're really good as well, so I've got to try and mention as many as I can. The first one comes from Still Void, and it's he sent me the link. It's Google's deep dreaming thing. That's the way that he describes it. Now, I've only had a 30-second look at the website while we've been talking, but it is indeed very cool and very technical. It seems to be an academic project studying neural networks, and part of the way that they're studying what neural networks are doing, the ones that the researchers have implemented, is by you throwing images at them and asking them to interpret images in certain ways. So visualizing what the neural networks seem to be doing by finding patterns mainly. I really skimmed over the website and this is probably 20 years worth of research. So it's definitely worth a look. But the end results, so the images that you can look at are the end results, are incredible. I mean, things are often described as being hallucinogenic or trippy, but this, for me, is the genuine article of what hallucinogenic things are, because what it is the neural network will start with one image and it'll interpret lots of different parts of the image with lots of other images that it already knows about. It's probably been fed millions of images, I don't know. So you get this kind of lucid dream where lots of other images are hanging off certain parts of one image. It's very difficult to describe.
There are lots of faces in these pictures as well, aren't they? Some of them
faces,
are quite disturbing.
Yeah,
maybe it's just me then.
Yes, they're right. Yeah, and so it's a little bit like those collage images where pixels are made up of parts of other images, except for the way that all of those smaller images are fitting in seem much more natural and weird and dreamlike.
I remember seeing an animated GIF, or GIF, if you'd rather, recently, where someone had put every frame through Deep Dream and then recollated them together.
Oh, right.
And that was pretty crazy.
So did it change every single frame, or was there some kind of animation, there was some kind of gradual movement to its interpretation?
It was some gradual movement to its interpretation. Yeah, it was weird.
So that's from Still Void. From Chemist 69, the Zim desktop wiki. I use it for almost everything, including documenting his work or her work. So that really looks like a really fast, convenient wiki that you can run on your desktop for making notes.
I wrote about that in that in some magazine that was the prototype for Linux Voice.
Beta.
It's just prototype Linux Voice.
Oh, excellent. Maybe it's time to look at it again. It looks great.
So, the basic advantage of that, isn't it, that it sort of it's a really simple markup, and it keeps all your history and makes it really easy to roll back to other stuff. And
I'm glad we've been able to fill in some of the blanks, because I've only just loaded the website. It seems related to that, Stillvoid chimes in with workflowy.com, which I'm guessing, considering the conversation on IRC, is a similar thing. A notebook for lists. Going on, James Olympus. I haven't been at my computer much for the last couple of weeks. My only find is that Polyfiller is brilliant. Polyfiller is good.
Something I discovered recently, regular Polyfiller, the stuff that comes in tubes, if you put it in big holes, obviously it cracks, everyone knows that. But if you get the powdered Polyfiller, it doesn't crack. So you can fill whopping great holes and replaster your room with it.
The problem I found with Polyfiller is it doesn't automatically paint for you. So like about 2 years ago, we filled all the holes in our house and walls. But, you know, there's just loads of white spots on our walls now.
Of course, if you use the powdered stuff and polyfill it over the whole lot,
yes,
you'd have a lovely white wall.
P. Waring, Tiddly Wiki, an open source single page application wiki, a single HTML file containing CSS and JavaScript. That looks interesting too. BT bought them. God, there really is lots on the IRC channel. Enum, I found a great site for learning bioinformatics genome sequencing that is a set of small problems that you write a Python script for and then submit the results to the website in real time. That's rosalind.info. I'll put the link in the notes. Chemist69 says that what he especially likes about Zim is that every page is a separate plain text document. Another one from Devilman, not a Linux fine, but something you might appreciate playing during its music. It's Dunk's Algo music. I'll put the link in the notes. And then Enom, this was a good one. There's my previous find that the Muppets song, was first written, and he quotes Wikipedia on this, so I hope it's right. It was first written for a documentary film about wild sexual activity and other behaviour in Sweden. That sounds like something out of Monty Python. Right, there are a few more, but I think that's enough of my terrible enunciation from the IRC channel. Excellent though. Does anyone else have a find they'd like to share?
I'll go then. It's actually quite a meta find. I was browsing Reddit the other day, and somebody was asking, is Richard Stallman always right? And I thought that would make a good voice of the masses question. So I posted a voice of the masses, and then Reddit linked back to that, and everyone was posting comments there. It was like 200 comments. And then Ben informed us that that was our third most popular story on Reddit. So a comment section linking to another comment section.
Linking back to another comment section, yeah. The navel-gazing world of the internet.
Yeah, and that's all that I've discovered, because I've just not been around. So
you've been travelling, haven't you?
I went down to Garmisch-Partenkirchen, yeah, and I went into a huge ravine, which was pretty cool.
Deliberately or accidentally?
that bit was planned. And then I went to the base of the Zugspitze, Germany's biggest mountain, cool. And then realized it cost €35 to go up on the cable car. So I thought, screw that, and just walked around instead.
What's the height? What's the height of the mountain?
It's 2,960 meters or so. I can't remember if I've mentioned this as a find before, but the border between Germany and Austria runs over the top of this mountain. And the height of the mountain from Germany is measured from the North Sea. The height of the mountain from Austria is measured from the Adriatic. This means that the Zugspitze is actually higher in Austria than in Germany. So Germany's biggest mountain is higher in Austria. That's a slap in the face.
That's awesome. shall I go next? Like Mike, I've been having a little bit of time out. We've got a bit of a longer issue, this current one that we're working on. But one semi-Linux related thing is that I can no longer live with DuckDuckGo's search results. I just can't do it. I just found myself typing exclamation mark G almost every time. Some of them are abysmal. So my current search engine, and I don't really know whether I trust it or not, but it's Start Page.
That's basically Google, isn't it?
But yeah, it basically is Google through a proxy. So I get exactly the same Google results as if I had a naked no-cookie install Google search. And I'm finding it much more effective than DuckDuckGo, unfortunately, as much as I admire DuckDuckGo's commitment to privacy and transparency and open source.
Yeah, DuckDuckGo is getting better. I did a roundup of search engines in issue 19, wasn't it? And yeah, the results are a lot better than a year ago, but sometimes they are lacking. And I know what you mean, Graham. It's quite frustrating when you know the results are probably better on Google, then you think, well, I might as well just go to Google then.
But I keep meaning to make a list of the most obvious examples and then even maybe send it off to the DuckDuckGo team, but it seems to miss some real fundamental. Like, you'll often find the main official site, like four or five links down, stuff like that. You know, and who wants, you know, some random comment on a site when you're looking for a site? So the other thing is that I haven't had much time to play on my PlayStation recently, but I bought a game called Alien Isolation. There's a tentative Linux link in that. There may be a Linux version coming up if the Steam install files to be believed. But really, it's just such a good game. It's from last year, so I bought it cheap, which is the best way of buying games. And it's terrifying. What's really great about it is that it's a recreation of Ridley Scott's Alien environment. It feels incredibly authentic. So this is like a film from 1979. It's the original Alien. You don't really see the alien throughout the film. It's all tension and stress and black. But what's so lovely about it is that the way that the sets were created is kind of on the cheap. You know, it's like 70s leather, white leather interiors, and lots of Douglas Trumbull kind of little gadgets, and CRT screens, you know, that are just green, and old AT systems that take an age to boot up. And the game really authentically recreates all this. And you play it for hours before you even get a whiff of the alien. So far, the fear of playing. So it is a horror game. You, just like in the original, you basically are lost in an abandoned space station, trying to get through the corridors, trying to escape, all the while knowing that the sounds and the scratches in the vents above you and around you could possibly be the single alien, the single indestructible alien on the ship. It's really good. It's a really good game. I really hope they make a Linux version of it. I'm really enjoying it. I'm hooked. They're my finds.
What a film. I've not watched that for ages.
No, I haven't seen it. It's really, they've gone to an awful lot of detail. The spacesuits, the lighting, you know the way they have those kind of big bulbous fishbowl helmets, and then like a single light, like a yellowish light that shone down onto their face. That kind of stuff. The game's really captured accurately. It's a great, great feeling of the movie. You just realise just how much skill is involved in, even though, you know, obviously, technology now, it's nothing like the future technology imagined in the late 70s, but there's still something really wonderful about the way that it was created so authentically, and it feels like you've lived in, you know, and that's brilliant. You know, it's the same way why those old Star Wars movies work without the computer graphics, because so much love has gone into the detailed models that even though you can tell that in the lens of a camera that they're models, often the effect is just much more immersive than CGI. Or maybe that's my age, but sorry.
No, it's CGI is killing music, just like home taping is.
Shall I go next?
Yeah.
My discoveries this fortnight are CGI. Well, specifically, data representation, data visualization. So there's a couple that I've come across recently that actually just looked really good in the way they sort of, the visualization, the imagery genuinely enhances the data and makes it easier to understand. And the first one I came across was the galaxy of Debian packages, where they sort of built this whole sort of swirling mass of all the packages from Debian, and they're sort of clustered together based on dependencies, and it's, you can see how they're all linked together and what the key packages, what are, you know, what are the linchpin ones that everything builds on, what are they. And it doesn't really aid your package management, but it just makes it a little bit easier to understand the sort of back end of Debian and how it all links together. And it also looks quite good as well.
Is it something you could, would fit onto A4, or is it something you could put on the inside back cover?
No, it's more of a sort of zoomy in-y, out-y, immersive thing. And that's at anvaka.github.io and vaka.github.io. And the second one, is, I mean, we regularly rail on cloud services because they steal all our data and use it to advertise to us, etc. But there are actually some genuinely useful, well, genuinely interesting things that they can do with the stolen data. And one I came across was the Strava heat map. We'll put a link to it in the show notes. And this is, Strava's a sort of exercise tracker. It's mostly for running and cycling. And on this one, you can see a massive heat map of, I think you can do it anywhere in the world, but I was looking in the UK, of all the routes that people run and cycle and how popular they each are. So as a cyclist, you can use it to see what are the good routes for cycling, because these light up in bright blue and you can see the little ones in sort of lower blue. And at a higher level, you can see which cities are good for cycling. You can see Birmingham is terrible for cycling. And there's just nothing
there. There's no
at all.
Air to breathe in Birmingham, though.
Yeah.
It's a poisonous fume.
Yeah.
Yeah, just a little highlight on Cannock Chase there, but obviously Bristol and London really light up and all this sort of thing. And it's a really useful bits of information. You know, if you want to know what's the best route from A to B from cycling, you can zoom in and see what ones that the cyclists use.
A bit like Google search algorithm for running and cycling.
Yeah, exactly. Which is, I mean, there's obviously a sort of bias in this is the route that people who use Strava use, and so they tend to be quite serious cyclists who want to be the best and care about beating invisible riders and that sort of thing. But it's certainly worth having a look if you're a cyclist or a runner.
I quite like cycling on my own and not meeting people. So it's useful for me, you know, just find the places and I'll go to Birmingham and do some cycling in Birmingham.
I've cycled in a lot of places and I've never found anywhere worse than Birmingham. It's that sort of point where because no one cycles there, drivers don't look for cyclists. I think they weren't intentionally trying to kill me, but the result was effectively the same.
Yeah.
And those are my finds. Actually, no, I've got another find that I was thinking as Mike talked about his on Reddit. There's a way of finding out what posts have been written about a particular domain. So the way I could tell that was our third most popular ever Reddit link was you can go to reddit.com/domain/ and then the domain name, so linuxvoice.com. And that'll list all the Reddit posts that have linked to linuxvoice.com.
3 years ago, a bunch of researchers found a security flaw in the keyless key fob things of Volkswagen cars. They were going to publish it, but before they did so, they gave Volkswagen 9 months' notice to say, "We found this flaw. It's a very interesting flaw. We want to tell the world about it. But here, have 9 months to fix it, to recall the affected cars or the affected car keys, in fact, and just change this small, tiny little transponder." And Volkswagen, rather than do this, issued a written injunction against them to stop them from publishing, which has only yesterday, been lifted. So, you know, well, for all that time, my Maserati has been at risk. and I'm annoyed.
Have they now fixed it?
I don't think they've fixed it, no. I think it's just that the flaw has now come to light.
That is terrible.
Well, just, you know, security by obscurity, it doesn't work. We know that it doesn't work. And to have spent, you know, thousands of pounds on a lovely Maserati Quattroporte, as I have, and have it at risk.
Oh, you're the one who's actually being paid from us then.
Well, I'm the one that has the bank account, so yeah, of course. Yeah.
At least some good's come of it.
Do you have the Linux Voice logo over it? Is that what our advertising budget is?
That's why I had to get the red one. This is just utterly terrible. This is, I mean, what a poor response. And for something that's very easily fixable, it's just to put your fingers in your ears and hope that it goes away. And, oh no, we'll take you to court, blah, blah, blah. Appalling behaviour from Volkswagen, the people's car. Terrible stuff.
I think this is a genuine and looming problem we're putting computers in all this stuff, but we haven't really... Well, firstly, it's generally quite poorly designed from a security point of view anyway, a lot of it. And secondly, there's no real update mechanism. I mean, you know, you don't plug your car keys into your Wi-Fi every night to get the latest software updates. I mean, it's an unsolved problem right now, and someone needs to solve it, because we can't have a future where just everything is insecure, and that's going to happen unless we find a way to secure it.
It's the, you know, when the Internet of Things finally strikes, it's going to throw up so many problems like this. And the only way of fixing it is to have things, you know, completely open.
Well, it's not just that. There isn't an update path for this. How do you update a set of car keys? Okay, yeah, you could post them back and that, but that works. But there's a sort of thing where we've been pushing to try and get stuff as cheap as possible and as smart as possible, and that means there's no money there to update it. You know, if you've bought, I don't know, a TV, but the margins on that TV are only 10%. How are they going to update that? Are you going to post your TV back and they reflash it? How do they pay someone to maintain it for the 10-year life of the TV and patch the security updates? I don't know.
I'm waiting for everyone to have internet-enabled fridges, and then 4chan's technology board finds a flaw and starts ordering everybody huge amounts of food or whatever.
Well, farmers could do that to order loads of milk.
There we go. Yeah.
Problem solved.
For all those farmers on 4chan.
Yeah, that's it. That's my discovery. I just found it really quite terrifying, and it should be a much bigger story. It'll be in the newspapers today, I imagine, because it only happened yesterday. But it won't be on a front page story or a second or a page two or page three. It'll be buried somewhere because it's a geeky, nerdy thing that no one really understands. No one really needs to understand because somebody else will sort it out for you.
Do you know how hard it is to exploit?
I don't know because I don't understand any of this stuff. It's somebody from the University of Birmingham and the University of Radboud University in the Netherlands. Yeah. So you could, you know, bike there and ask him or her.
Not to Birmingham, though.
Oh, no. Well, we'll never know. We'll never know.
And they are our finds.
Now it's time for our halfway reminder. Still to come, we've got that thing. We've got Voice of the Masses. And we've also got a reminder that Linux Voice is a great magazine. It's available at WH Smith's and WH Smith's Travel, and it's available in Sainsbury's and Asda and Tesco's, but not Morrison's.
Issue 19 goes on sale today.
Today!
Yeah.
Which one's that then?
It's the Linux in the UK.
Yeah, just time for a self-indulgent look at how Britain has made Linux better than it would be if it weren't for Britain.
So eloquent. Why didn't we put that on the cover?
England make Linux more good.
Yeah. So that's gonna be on sale. And if you like that so much that you want to subscribe, you can do so at shop.linuxvoice.com. And if you don't like paper, you can subscribe to a digital version, which includes EPUBs and PDFs, but it doesn't include DRM. So you can download it, share it, read it, and put it on more than one device. But don't share it, obviously, because that's killing,
no,
that's,
not, ki- sir.
That's killing music.
Hang on, by not putting DRM on, are we killing music?
Yeah, we're funding terrorism and piracy.
Oh no. Hello. What about Hollywood? Will they be okay? Or are we going to make Brad Pitt poor?
I'll ask him next time I see him.
Right. When you drive up in your Maserati. Yeah.
So he might nick it because he's a bit of a prankster. So, speaking of pranksters, voice of the masses, should we pay more attention to Richard Stallman? He's a jolly japester. Some people dismiss him as a kook, an old hacker who's out of touch with the computing industry today. But also many of us have huge respect for the man, but we sometimes have trouble reconciling our computing habits with his hardline views on proprietary software. He has an uncanny ability for being right. He's predicted all sorts of stuff about DRM and sharing technologies and how companies try to restrict our rights online. And he was doing this way before widespread internet adoption, when it was really in its infancy. He was looking ahead and saying, well, you know, if we don't lock this down, then, you know, the evil publishers will try and exploit us. And he is absolutely right. But he's also a little bit of a, well, yeah, dismissed sometimes. So is that fair? Should we listen to Richard Stallman more? Discuss. Mike.
Hello.
You've lost the news, Mike.
Ickdickton, Lickton.
You've met Richard Stallman.
I have indeed met Richard Stallman, and I also have huge respect for him, and I think he does see these things far in advance. He is very strict, very hardline in his views, and I think a lot of the time the big rants about calling it GNU/Linux and ranting about the name open source is can be awkward. Okay, I know there's an important distinction with free software and open source. So sometimes some of his energies seem a bit sort of pointed in the wrong direction. But on the other hand, he's been there. He was part of a hacker movement in the 70s, and he saw everything get commercialized and copyrighted and this geek community reduced to everybody rushing around to chase up money. So I do think we should listen to him more, yeah.
Yep. Listen to RMS, says Animation 1138. A few months ago, he made a speech, and part of it said how, although slavery was illegal, it still went on in the UK. I live in the UK and have no knowledge of this. I thought, what a kook you are, Stallman. Then arrests were made of people who were keeping other humans as slaves. RMS is a genius. It's like he takes advantage of glitches in the Matrix to see into the future. Daniel says, also used the word genius, I don't think we should be dependent on RMS in person to fulfil this role. Now, that wasn't just a role. There is no... yeah, as a figurehead, yes. I don't think RMS is appropriate, but more as a seer, as a, you know, the wild-eyed prophets on top of the mountain. I think he's, you know, he's what free software needs in that role, not as a presenter. Daniel says, I don't think we should be dependent on RMS in person to fulfil this role as figurehead. Other people can articulate a position based on what makes RMS be right. Yes. He's not really a genius in the sense that what he says is rarely surprising. It's just a stringent application of a relatively small set of principles. I think a lot of the time when people dismiss RMS, it's because the principles are too rigid, are too stringent. Graham, you're nodding to that.
Yeah, I think these are really good points. I think I haven't read the comments, but the idea that Stallman is a genius, I've not really thought that before, but that's what I was nodding at. In fact, you talking about him being like a statesman or not being well-equipped to be a statesman kind of reminds me of other geniuses, like Bobby Fischer, for example, the famous genius American chess player who would play a whole room of people while he was a child, and then went on really to well, this isn't suggesting that Richard Stallman suffering from mental illness, but he had a very difficult middle age and later years, and you know, flirted with controversy over the Cold War politics. And I think this often happens with people with a genius, and that their talent is obvious and everybody respects them for it. But that doesn't mean that we have to agree with everything else that they do, or the way that they represent themselves. And I think Stallman, it's right that he is recognized for being in right most of the time on these things that are so important to us. And it doesn't matter if he isn't the correct person to be the statesman for those ideas. And that's kind of up to us. And I think it's becoming increasingly important, because I think the free software message is becoming marginalized by more permissive licenses. And it's becoming a dangerous time.
Shane Kay says, RMS's opinions on and vision for free software are admirable, but not always practical. With my free software geek hat on, I would wholeheartedly agree with his philosophies, as they go even deeper than mere ones and zeros. When you really listen to him, his message is very simple. Sharing and collaboration will make everything, not just software, better. It's hard to argue with that. With my realist hat on, however, I despair. His vision is still a long way from becoming the norm. Proprietary software and hardware is good for business, or so we've been told. The open source model has seen a lot of success in recent years, but it's very difficult to see the Microsofts and Apples of the world opening up their source code anytime soon. And P. Waring says, I think we should listen to him, but only as one voice amongst many. He raises some interesting and insightful points, but his uncompromising position sometimes undermines what he's trying to say. He's okay when speaking to the choir, but I wouldn't want to use an RMS speech talk article as my initial opener with someone who knows little about open source. Yeah, I normally see somewhere between Linus, pragmatic, and RMS, idealistic, as being the right place for me. And just to back that up, Niels K says that RMS is the equivalent of a militant vegan for the software world. The content of what he says and writes is true, but the way it's delivered is problematic and more damaging for the cause, just because it sounds like some crazy person is talking.
Yeah. And I suppose it could be more of the what the FSF should do as perhaps his vehicle for furthering the gains of free software. And not meaning to tie it into issue 19 that goes on sale today, but our discussion with John Sullivan, the executive director of the FSF, covers exactly that. And the problem that the FSF has and other organisations in a similar position is that they're underfunded and don't have much support. Mm. And that is something that we can change or try and help to change.
I mean, a proper, we've, you know, again, not to blow our own trumpet too much, but there's a four-page feature on Windows 10 in this issue coming out about all the ways in which Windows 10 fails. It would be great to have some sort of campaigning organisation out there and putting out press releases for the media, you know, explaining to the largely tech illiterate journalists exactly what it means when your computer is broadcasting all of your personal data back to Microsoft by default. Because that just seems to have gone largely unnoticed, and no one's going to punish Microsoft for that. If only we had some sort of Linux Foundation or...
It's not going to happen with the Linux Foundation. This is something that we had many years ago, isn't it? We've had this similar conversation about how there should be like a Linux marketing department.
Yeah.
Marketing departments who shift everything that's said to the benefit. We don't have anything like that as in the free software Linux world. Nobody who's just there specifically to put the positive spin on what we do and a negative spin on all the wrongs that's being done.
Like a rebuttal unit.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, when there's, you know, Apple releases some story saying, you know, we've done this and it's great. And then, you know, half an hour later, every journalist gets something in their inbox, you know, with a quote backed up by fact.
Yeah. Hmm.
Just on a side note about the old principles malarkey, I'm sure that Matthew Garrett was saying on Twitter that he was on the flight, same flight as Jim Zemlin, who's the boss of the Linux Foundation, and he was using Apple's OS X on his laptop.
I tried to get an interview with Jim Zemlin, but they didn't get back to me.
But did you get an interview with Matthew Garrett?
I did actually get an interview
with Matthew Garrett. Well, that's much better. Much better, much more readable, much less leverage and synergizing and all that nonsense. Oh,
Matthew Garrett's wonderful, yeah.
He's far too clever.
I'd be really interested to meet him, actually, because he's really, really technical, but also really sort of interested in the social justice side of things, isn't he?
And he's a member of the board of the FSF, you know, that kind of stuff. Also, he believes strongly in Secure Boot and Coros is where he works now. So he's somebody who also has really interesting opinions and is able to back them up.
Back to RMS. So Andrew Conway says, RMS strikes me as a highly rational and consistent thinker, and as a result speaks with great clarity and conviction. The problem for me is that my work colleagues, friends, family members and nearly everybody else are far less rational and consistent. This means I'm forced to compromise constantly, but we need people like RMS to remind us what the consequences of too much compromise or lazy thinking might be. Yeah.
I think
the world is not perfect.
I think someone earlier described him as a monk, and I think that's quite a good comparison to make. That he has a really, really strict set of principles that he sticks to, and to a certain extent he's only able to stick to them because people make allowances for him because of who he is. People book his travel, people will, you know, book venues for him to speak, and they can't get away with the same level of sticking to their principles. So while we may all wish to emulate him, it's pretty much impossible really, because we have to live in the real world and we're not closeted in the same way. But at the same time, we do benefit from having someone who really looks at it that strictly and goes through and says, this is what, you know, this is how it can be, this is what it's like if you really stick to it.
Yeah, it's good to know that somewhere out there, whatever happens in the computing industry, Stallman will be there doing everything possible to run free software down to the last bit and byte on his computer. Even if, like a few years ago when he was running this tiny Limo netbook thing.
Yeah,
which is
the remote.
I saw him using it when I met him a few years ago. And, you know, Richard's a fairly big guy and trying to use this tiny little thing. But he was, you know, it must have been really bad for his hands and stuff. But he was so committed to free software. It was the only fully 100% free machine he could find. Today he uses a glug, you know, rebadged ThinkPad thing with purely free software on, but he's it's impractical for a lot of us. He basically just uses Emacs, so a lot of us need to do more with that computing. But it's good to know he's there.
On a similar note, I was surprised to read in your interview from this issue, Graham, that the FSF uses Trisquel on their servers.
Yeah, yeah.
Because of their commitment to free software.
Yeah. I guess it's what you... I hadn't actually thought about it until he answered that question. But yeah,
no.
Also Replicant on his phone.
Ah.
I think the FSF partly helps to fund one of the two developers that go to help make Replicant.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Jeff Moe makes a very good point. Many have made predictions about the future. Nearly all have failed. Stallman's track record shows his firm grasp on technology and society. He should definitely be listened to. Aubrey, we must listen to RMS because he is one of the very few experts of a science that he has almost created alone, the flossology. Discerning the floss amongst the ocean of proprietary software, finding the obfuscating codes for the user, the closed hardwares, etc. On his example, I hope one day we will create a flossology diploma in university, or even a certificate for high schoolers to make other RMSs. There's plenty of food for thought in terms of like ethics of technology, philosophy of science. You know, I can see free software being added to that.
There's also some really interesting, it's quite old now, but some papers that ASI, Cass Raymond, wrote on the economics of free software. And looking at it from a purely economic point of view in terms of essentially gift giving and how that benefits you and the sort of how the non-tangible benefits can be quantified.
Another one. Francesco Toro says, Stallman is right and we should listen to him. Proprietary software is evil and should be banned worldwide. It should be illegal to distribute proprietary software.
That's a bit extreme.
But... Splitter.
I don't think the threat is proprietary software anymore. I think it's permissive licenses like Apache and MIT. And I think there's a growing kind of culture of, especially in like startups and big companies, where they don't want to get into the technical details. The GPL and copyleft licenses are harder to administer. They need lawyers to look at them, whereas you put something under MIT license, developers can do it really without having to ask a company's legal team. And there seems to be, I mean, this has been growing over the last few years, there does seem to be a growing trend for that to continue. And that I think that has a bad impact on copyleft and future free software.
I think for a lot of people, the permissive licenses are ethically better. And that's from the point of view of you purely want to increase technological adoption of something. Look, for, I mean, the classic example would be the TCP/IP stack, the MIT license one, or the BSD license one. Certainly back in the early days, just got incorporated into everything and suddenly everything could talk to each other. And that only happened because it was permissively licensed. Microsoft didn't go out and write their own and create a proprietary network protocol that sort of almost worked with others but kind of didn't. They just, everyone used the same code, everything communicated, happy days. And that
I think there's a place for it, and I think that's a really good example. But with companies like Apple taking stuff that's been licensed MIT or BSD and then basically taking it and making it at the moment, never giving anything back, and this happening in countless other ways, and especially places that are becoming integral to the way that mobile devices operate with like enclosed gardens.
I think the debate is framed a little unfairly when you say Apple takes something, because they don't remove anything from open source. There's still the still the BSDs that they took it from. They didn't suddenly make those closed source. They built on it and didn't release their changes. So they haven't taken anything. They've just changed it and not released theirs, which I'm not saying is good or
but
bad.
Going back to the voice of the masses question about Stallman, I think this is something Stallman would be very concerned and worried about, because it means that basically Apple is gaining an advantage without us as users of their hardware, or especially their iPhone or closed garden users, getting any of the advantages of free software or any of the kind of liberation that comes with using open source free software.
Maybe, but another option would be if OS X hadn't been built on BSD, if that hadn't been an option, then Apple would probably have tried to write it from scratch. OS X probably wouldn't have been anywhere near as good. The whole thing could have failed, and we could now be living in a Windows monopoly where no other operating system could interact.
Or Linux would have done better. But Linux would have been more successful.
Only if there'd been the hardware to support it.
I mean, Android, for example, the reason why we have a semi-open source operating system is because the Linux kernel's GPL. If that had been Apple, they would have just taken it all and it would be completely closed, and we wouldn't have any such choices as CyanogenMod or Replicant or being able to install D packages if and Google decides they don't want it.
Yeah.
But yeah, that is a whole new debate.
Yeah.
Right, we've been going on for long enough now, so let's have just two more comments to close everything down. Jacko says, for anyone new to GNU Linux, Stallman's explanation of the four freedoms is absolutely essential. I'm going to interject here in square brackets and say it really, really annoys me that the four freedoms is numbered 0 to 3. Whoever said earlier that it's preaching to the choir by using alienating terminology like that, you're not helping.
But here's an interesting point. Who is Stallman trying to preach to? If he's trying to preach to programmers, then doing zero indexing, maybe he's not trying to reach the regular crowd. Maybe he thinks, if I can persuade programmers and geeks, then other people will step up and finish the battle for me.
Yeah, fair point. Never thought of that before. So the explanation of the four freedoms is essential, but I quit paying attention to him because after the first four or five talks, it was like a broken record. Every talk was almost exactly the same. He spoke in Leicester or Rugby or Coventry or somewhere a few years ago, and I just had a look on YouTube and decided that as all of his speeches were the same, I just wouldn't bother going to see him. However, recently I looked at one of his recent presentations and was pleasantly surprised to find out there's a bit more to his shtick these days. The explosion of smartphone and tablet devices, app stores, the cloud, and the associated unethical business practices have given Stallman so much more to sink his teeth into that it's breathed new life into his presentations. I, for one, like this new Stallman. I hope he continues to sharpen his rhetoric and generate new and improved arguments against proprietary software. Stallman is at his best when he's fresh, relevant, and entertaining. I kind of think of Stallman as a bit like a Scott Walker or Kate Bush figure, in that I won't necessarily listen to everything that he does, but I'm glad he's out there. There's a lot of stuff on that he's said, which is, you know, quite bonkers. He doesn't want you to buy him a parrot, for example. Sometimes he doesn't want to eat breakfast, but he doesn't want you to ask him why he doesn't want to eat breakfast. And other strangeness. So I think that disqualifies him from being a figurehead of a movement, really. But as a wise man, as a prophet, I think he is what we need.
Hear, hear.
That is indeed a good place to stop. Yeah.
That's all the weather.
That is all the weather.
Thanks, Andrew.
Thanks, readers and listeners, for your insight. It is great. I mean, we spend too much time talking to each other and ourselves. So, you know, I sometimes feel like my brain is in a bit of a bubble, but it's always just brilliant to read comments on the internet that aren't horrible, flamey rant fests.
Right, so that's it. Thanks, everyone. Thanks for listening.
See you in 2 weeks.
Hopefully. That's deadline week, so let's see.
Yeah, let's not promise that. We'll meet again someday. Bye-bye.
Bye.
So long. Adieu.
Bye.